as a PPG company. Claire Hamilton Hall was a former Northwestern chemistry major about 1900 that became an officer in the PPG outfit. And at that time I was consulting for PPG when this paint and varnish division was up at Milwaukee. And the head of it was Howard Gerhardt, who was one of our PhDs. And he's the one that told me earlier, ask one of your officers. I ultimately asked the vice president, Peyton Wild, to approach the PPD, PPG people for some cash, because they had some at the University of Chicago that they were not going to renew. And probably if they were approached, it might come to Northwestern, which it did. And Gerhardt also there saw to it that I should have a new title with some increase in pay, which was also a PPG grant based on that aspect of it, I think. I had an idea it was going to be given to the department for departmental use, but in place of that, it was given for a professorship.
We mentioned your book on the pyrolysis of organic compounds earlier. That was 1929.
I think, isn't it pyrolysis of carbon compounds? Maybe it's organic.
It might be carbon.
Yeah.
Were you approached to do that, or did you start that and then approach a publisher?
I started that, and then I asked Julius Stieglitz at the University of Chicago, who was the head of the committee that decided if those books would be ACS monographs.
I see.
And he apparently was happy to do it. And that was a long job of writing.
Well, you've done a lot of that. I wanted to...
Well, I tell you, to actually do that, I started a course here for graduate students on this decomposition of compounds at high temperatures, which I didn't know anything about. And from Monday at 9 o'clock until Wednesday at 8 o'clock, I was just having to work terribly in order to get what I was going to say on Wednesday. But it was that kind of thing that made it possible to write the book.
I see.
When did you get into sugar chemistry?
Into what?
Sugar chemistry.
Well,
it's a long way from pyrolysis.
I was a consultant for Corn Products Refining Company, who actually there gave the university some cash with which to do some work on carbohydrates. And that was to me. I could pick any topic I wanted to, providing it was something having to do with carbohydrates. And that is how I got into carbohydrates, with money. That crash stuff, you know.
Yes, you had your first paper in 1932.
Okay.
Pentose reactions, and the student that was working with you was a Quaker Oats fellow.
That's right.
I mean, he was supported by Quaker Oats.
His name was Eisenhower, wasn't it?
Well, I'm not sure which.
Well, it's immaterial.
But then you did that same year. You had a pyrolysis of furan, which was also developed from. So you were still getting your pyrolysis work in. You also back in 31.
Well, I had some help from Quaker Oats too.
Okay.
I was consulting for them which didn't have anything to do at all with what I was doing some work on. That is, I didn't ever do any problems here that were part of company problems. I'd just take a trip and talk to them on the company problems. But it was easier to get some cash if they knew you and if you knew them to do some actual work, and I asked for it indirectly a few times, but usually, well, for example, like Pabst Brewing Company gave me some money for carbohydrate work too. That was because of Carl Miner. Miner was a consultant for Pabst, and he also was a consultant for Corn Products. And it was his influence that he said, well, look, why don't you give Herd some cash to keep on doing the work? He's publishing some of the pages, and you'll see, and this will help him do more. But he was really a really great friend, and also a tennis player with a court up there north of here. His home was either Winnetka, I think there's the one north of that. Name is Glencoe, that's it. And I was invited to play up there pretty much, and we got to know each other better that way than just by means of chemistry.
I don't think Professor Herd can have realized how much chemists in these companies looked forward to his coming, because in many companies, PPG for instance, the chemistry was not particularly good. Mm-hmm. And you were the one bright light. You would come and spend the whole day there, and one could talk chemistry to you, and you would understand.
Yeah.
Christensen, the lawyer, for instance, didn't understand.
Well, as a matter of fact, that was true with quite a lot of companies.
I'm sure.
Yeah. They ordinarily had a plan, sort of planned out in advance what we might take up, and then I'd be steered to various people to talk to on that idea. I'm sure that taught me as much as it taught them, if not more, because you have a perspective that you just don't ever get if you're not part of a company. That is, in other words, what PPG was doing, I wouldn't tell anybody else, but it would direct my thinking in a lecture that I was going to give. And I think the companies knew they could talk to me freely. If they can't, you're not much of a consultant.
You also had some work published in 1931, which was supported by Midgley and Webb of the Ethyl Corporation on the pyrolysis of lead compounds. How did you make that contact?
Well, by way of Thomas Midgley. He, I don't quite know how it started, but we had really quite well correspondence. And probably I could hunt up my old notes, and if I haven't, we'll toss them out, but he knew me and I knew him.
I see.
And he had some cash with which he was able to direct my way. I didn't ever ask him for that, though.
Did that come about because there was some concern about the public health with decomposition of tetraethyl lead at that time?
I don't think so. But I just can't recall. Perhaps it's organic mercury that we had at Northwestern. How about some organic lead work here? I think there's more on that kind of basis.
I see. I also wanted to ask you about something that I had not known about till I read the paper you wrote about the Institute of Chemistry.
Oh, yes.
Whitmore had the first one, ran the one here, I think, which was the second one.
Do you recall the name George Rosengarten?
Yes.
he was quite a wealthy man, I think, in the East with an industry, I don't know which one. But Whitmore approached him to have something that would put our name forward. That is, in other words, Whitmore was a booster trying to get people to realize that there was a chemistry department at Northwestern. Well, he started this Institute of Chemistry, in which he gets some well-known speakers to address the crowd that came during the time. And with the second one, he went to England to get Sir James Irvin here for the whole 6 weeks of the Institute. Well, that was really a scoop. Whitmore had to go to Scotland to get him, and he was happy, of course, but it was not because of hubris. It was because he was boosting Northwestern. And he was that kind of person. Lewis could never have done it, and I could never have done it.
Wasn't Whitmore's nickname Rocky?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Frank Clifford Whitmore. I haven't any idea.
I just wondered, because I've heard him called that.
That's right. Rocky Whitmore. Probably a Harvard nickname or something, but I don't know.
How long did that Institute of Chemistry last?
2 years.
Just the 2 years?
Yeah. And it simply died a natural death.
Given the attempts of the ACS today to try and promote chemistry again, why it would be, and looking at the program, it was quite a program of speakers. And wasn't part of that also public recognition of chemistry, not just within chemistry circles, but wasn't it also partly to get public recognition of chemistry?
At the Institute of Chemistry,
yes.
You mean? No, there's more to get public recognition of Northwestern University.
Okay.
That was what was in the back of his mind.
Was the department growing under his leadership?
Well, not tremendously in size, but it certainly did expand every year. Yeah, it was sort of a slow development. But keep in mind, it was zero about 1920.
That's right.
And the thing that we actually had to do to get graduate students was teaching assistant pay and fellowship pay. Once in a while, you'd get one that would pay his own way, but very rarely.
What kind of students were you able to attract?
Only the better ones. The best.
How many PhD students did you have, all in all?
Total. You mean at that time?
No, in your lifetime.
Oh, how many have I had?
Yes.
Oh, I'd have to add them up, but probably 100 or so. All that I could do would be to go through my old notebooks and see what the names are. But the easier way would be to take the papers that I've got and read the titles and add them up. They aren't all in the postdoctoral category, but most of them are.
Most of you, or all of your graduate students, did have papers then.
Yeah.
But you see, you have other cases like Bob Woodward, where many worked with him but got their PhD but no paper.
Well, I wasn't that way. That is, in other words, I would try to make a paper out of a dissertation and put it under that guy's name with mine attached.
It's much fairer that way.
Well, I had a purpose in putting my name first, because if you want to hunt anything up, it's my name that people could find.
Sure.
If you have the other preceding in an index, you've got a terrible job.
It's very frustrating in the older chemical abstracts to see that. You
yeah.
look for someone that says C, and then you have all these other names you have to look
yeah.
look for.
And as a matter of fact, I'm the one that had the problem they worked on in the first place. They just did the work.
Did you assign problems, or did you allow students to select problems?
Well, I would offer probably three to choose from if they wanted to work with me, mm-hmm. and they would pick which one of that they wanted to do. Would that be an answer to your question?
Yes.
Sure.
To have them come and tell me that they have a problem that they want to work on, that almost never happens. Mm-hmm. Not by my choice, but they don't have problems.
Did you have postdocs in those days?
A few, yeah. And some were pretty good, some weren't so good. But I think there are more of that category now than there were then, percentage-wise, I mean.
Who were the best student you ever had?
Hmm?
Who were the best student you ever had?
Oh, there are half a dozen I could name. One was Max Pollock. One was Paul Austin, who, as a matter of fact, was not one of my PhD boys. He took a undergraduate work at Madison, Wisconsin, and there's a poor bachelor's in chemistry because he thought about it too late. He arrived with really a bad preparation. He was here under me, that is, I had an application, I had some cash. He worked that year, but he couldn't pass the master's exam. He went to Cornell the next year, and I told him next year at Cornell to take it over again at Cornell, which he did, and he passed. But he's a pretty high-class individual. Do you know of him?
No, I don't.
Well, I've got a paper here that I think I can find somewhere.
It'd be nice if we could look forward to being 94 like that.
Oh, yes. Yes.
He has a C grant to do some work on clam shells.
Very interesting.
How's that for an organic chemist?
That's interesting.
I at least knew that it was in my office somewhere.
One of the things that I also wanted to talk to you about was your involvement with getting that organic model kit produced.
Yeah.
Evidently, that was born partly out of your frustration of teaching stereochemistry or three-dimensional structures to students.
That's right. And because Toy Tinkers was here in Evanston as a company that made toys. And I even had them spend about 3 weeks thinking that they could make these, but the problem was all that they knew how to do was to drill a hole straight through. And their supplied us the pegs practically at cost, and they told us, the person in Maine, to hunt for how to get the balls, because those were the balls that they used, except they weren't put in properly. But I actually there had the original idea, but about a week later or so Wallace Broad and Cecil Board at Ohio State approached them on the same problem.
Really?
Yeah. And they called me up. And, well, I said, I know them. Let me get in touch with them. Well, they ultimately turned the project down. And they said, if you want to do it on your own, why, we'll be happy to hand the pegs to you practically at cost. I don't think you'll want to lose money, but they didn't want to make any. And Wallace Broad went to Maine to spend about a week there with the people that were drilling holes and taught them how to drill tetrahedral holes. But it was a godsend in teaching. I don't have any idea what's happened to it. We actually there kept it up as a company for quite a number of years. Didn't ever make money. Our idea was to have it be so cheap that you could insist that the students actually buy one. And we put it at about $1 a box. And the profit, I think, was about 2 cents.
How did you market this? Did you have a name for it?
Molecular Models.
I see.
That was a name that's on every box. I have some yet here.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And who handled all the paperwork and the ordering?
That was done at Columbus, Ohio, by somebody that they hired, I guess, and then the cost was split three ways, or at least I assume it did. I at least had some that I paid when they told me how much it was.
And then, sorry, that's the same thing that Sargent took over in, what, 1949?
Yeah, that's right.
Like
you have actually there seen that box, haven't you?
Well, I have a Sargent box from years ago that I picked up.
An oblong one, about an inch high? Yeah, well, that's probably exactly the same box, providing it has printed on it the word Molecular Models.
Well, this one the one I have is a Sargent one, so it's later than the early one.
Yeah.
Did you ask your students, tell your students they had to buy one of your kits?
Certainly did. And what made that profitable was because of the large number of students at Ohio State. Ours had to have it here, but ours is trivial compared to them because we don't have agriculture, we don't have the big engineering courses that they do, and we don't have very many chemistry students. I mean, they're compared to them. Ours added to it, but what they had was a big bunch of sales. And we purposely, though, purposely devised some experiments to do in the laboratory with those box of models. In other words, we could insist that they do it, and by observation, we were in the lab to see to it they did. And with that help, we hoped that they would have it help them in the textbook stuff. But I just didn't ever have any problem with stereochemistry after that.
You have someone at the door.
You're right. There are to appoint two scholars for senior research at Northwestern bearing my name, which each one all of the departments that are interested will put in the name of the best candidate that they're offering, and they'll pass it on, and a committee will pick two out of that list. So they'll get $500 a piece.
Supplying the funds. Hmm? What you didn't mention is that you are supplying the funds.
Hmm?
You are supplying the funds.
Well, part of it anyway.
Could I keep this for your file?
No.
Is that the only copy you have?
That's the only one I have.
Okay.
Well, I can make a little copy of it if you want one.
All right. When you have it. Sometime. I'd like to put that in the file.
Okay.
We were talking about those molecular model kits. Did you sell them to other institutions? Did you advertise in Journal of Chemical Education?
I don't think we ever advertised. I think there's correspondence with professors that we knew, mm-hmm. and we told them that if they were interested, let us know, and we'd send the right amount to them. On that, the details of that, though, were pretty much with Board and Broad.
Okay.
I'm happy I didn't have it.
How did they compare with the Fieser models? You know, Louis Fieser also wanted them as cheap
well,
as possible.
These were first.
Sure.
After you put out something, then some other people can improve on. You have seen these, haven't you? These old molecular models.
We have the Fieser.
You haven't.
No, but have you seen the earlier ones?
Certainly.
Well,
but in those days, Aldrich couldn't sell them because Aldrich didn't exist. You have to tell us at lunch. You can join us for lunch, can't you? You have to tell us why you think Döring was.
Well, I don't think he was. So this was, yes, this one still says manufactured by molecular models.
Yeah, and but this was after
Sergeant.
After we got out of it. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any idea what happened to him now.
Oh, I think you can still buy them. I think they're still in the Sergeant catalog.
I see. Well, as a teaching device, I'm going to have to ask some of our teachers if they ever use them anymore or what do they use. Because it was a godsend to me to have this for carbohydrates and proteins.
Excuse my moment again.
How did you get Sargent to take it over?
I think they asked us.
I see.
But I'm not positive about that either.